From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
He had a longtime fear of being poisoned.
Although there hasn't been a mad dash of psychiatrists and psychologists with a snap diagnosis of obsessive compulsive behavior, failed Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton was at the Grammys poking fun at President Trump.
One reason why he liked to eat at McDonald's. Nobody knew he was coming, and the food was safely pre-made.
Clinton was one of a number of people who were reading from a book about President Trump that's gained notoriety lately. But the selection of material for the former First Lady, Senator, Secretary of State, and twice-failed presidential candidate seemed ironic, to say the least, given her husband's well-known penchant for fast food.
All right, boys. Let's stop in here for a second. I'm a little parched from the jog.
Sir, we've only been jogging for 3 blocks. Besides, Mrs. Clinton asked us not to let you into any more fast food places.
Jim, let me tell you something. There's going to be a whole bunch of things we don't tell Mrs. Clinton.
It appears that some secrets are about to come out. The so-called memo, this was from a press conference held on Tuesday by Speaker of the House, Republican Paul Ryan.
Why is it okay for Republicans in the House to release a Republican memo and not at the same time as a Democratic memo to give the American public a full picture, or at least both sides of the argument behind this underlying intelligence?
Mano, what's okay is to follow the process as the process is laid out, and that's precisely what is happening. I would remind you that the Democrats tried blocking the rest of the members of Congress from even having access to the memo that the majority wrote. Yesterday, the majority voted to provide access to the Democrats' memo. The process is this. It's an 11G process. You've all probably reported on it, which is a memo gets released to the broader members. They read it. Then you go and scrub to make sure that no sources and methods are being compromised. And then you go through the process of releasing it. The majority's memo already went through that process. That process is underway. This memo that we just got popped on us yesterday is now going through that process. And I would just tell you, unlike the Democrats on the Intelligence Committee who voted to deny access to this memo to the broader members, Republicans supported doing so.
Devin,
and so now, Devin actually made the motion. So now it will go through that 11G process just like this other memo did. Now, let me just say a few things. What's that? The chairman went to the FBI to go through the memo to make sure that we were protecting any sources and methods, and we are confident that we are. None of that work has been done on this new memo that no one has yet read. But the Republicans voted to allow the rest of the members to read it so that it can go through that process.
Why not hold back?
You've asked enough.
Why not ask the Republicans to wait and release their people at the same time as Democrats release theirs to overcome?
We're going to go through the process as the process is laid out, and it's ironic that the majority voted to actually give access to this memo while the minority voted to deny that access. So I think the irony is a little rich here these days. Casey. Let me make,
in a partisan way.
Yeah, let me make 4 points here. I think there are, you know, as we think about all of this, I actually wrote some of this down. First, there are legitimate questions about whether an American's civil liberties were violated by the FISA process. We are the legislative branch of government. It is our job to conduct oversight on behalf of the American people of the executive branch in case any powers were abused and civil liberties were abused by the executive branch. So there's a very legitimate issue here as to whether or not an American's civil liberties were violated in the FISA process. That's point number one. Point number two, this is a completely separate matter from Bob Mueller's investigation, and his investigation should be allowed to take its course. Point number three, there may have been malfeasance by people at the FBI. And let me finish my points. There may have been malfeasance at the FBI by certain individuals. So it is our job in conducting transparent oversight of the executive branch to get to the bottom of that. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. And so what we want is all of this information to come out so that transparency can reign supreme and accountability can occur. There's a fourth point I want to make, and that is the institution of the DOJ, of the FBI, is a very important institution for American life. It's a very important institution for keeping the rule of law intact. The men and women, the vast number of the men and women over at DOJ, over at FBI, are professionals doing their jobs and doing their jobs well. The people over in the field office in Milwaukee, at the FBI office, are helping keeping heroin and opioids out of our schools. So we want the people of the FBI to know that we respect their job, we respect who they are and what they do, and all the more reason why we need to have transparency and accountability to hold people accountable if they violated the rules, if they acted in a wrong, improper way. And that is what we are doing here.
Do you think they did, based on all the other conclusions that are being drawn by this investigation in the House are being held until the end? Why is it important to get this conclusion?
It would have been great to have all the documents that we requested months ago, but we did not. So as you know, the Congress has been asking for all of these documents from the executive branch so that we can do the executive branch oversight. It's the inspector general who just told us a couple of days ago they all of a sudden found the 5,000 text messages that were lost. So it would be nice if all of this information that Congress had requested would have been delivered when we asked for this stuff last August. So we have not been getting the information until fairly recently. That is why this is taking so long.
Last question. Juan.
There's been some reporting that the president wants to fire Deputy AG Rod Rosenstein. Do you think that would be a wise decision?
I think Rod Rosenstein is doing a fine job. I have no reason to see why he should do that. Rosenstein was hired after this last election. I think the people at the FBI, at the DOJ, need to clean their own house if there are problems in their own house, and I think that's really important. And just, he came in after this last election.
Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan at a press conference Tuesday morning. Monday's daily press conference at the White House had this surprise.
Over the weekend, the White House released a framework for responsible immigration reform that will protect our people, put the interests of American workers first, and provide a permanent solution to DACA. Our framework includes four pillars: border security, including the wall, DACA legalization, ending extended family chain migration, and eliminating the visa lottery, moving us toward a merit-based system of immigration. We look forward to working with Congress to pass and sign legislation that addresses each of these four pillars.
RT's Caleb Maupin takes a look at what this could mean.
Amnesty for 1.8 million people who entered the United States illegally. That's what Donald Trump has just agreed to. Not exactly a hardline conservative policy. Doesn't really fit what we're used to hearing about the Donald.
I think the president might be racist.
President Trump's racist comments.
Inflammatory racist language.
The situation that we're used to has been completely reversed. At this point, the guys at the right-wing outlet known as Breitbart are furious with Trump. Now, Trump's image is loud, brash, and tough. You think he'd never apologize for anything. But he recently did apologize for making tweets that were offensive to Muslims.
I would certainly apologize if you'd like me to do that. I know nothing about them.
It's been over a year, and Trump is starting to look a little bit liberal. A lot of the right wing are disappointed, and some of the left wing doomsayers are looking a little bit silly.
You're not having a terrible, terrible dream.
Is there going to be remnants of a neo-fascist movement that he leads in this country after this election?
This guy is a complete clown.
Remember Steve Bannon, that scary far right winger who was supposedly directing Donald Trump behind the scenes? Yeah, he is not on good terms with the White House these days.
I think the president's statement is extremely clear what his position on Mr. Bannon is. It was pretty lengthy and pretty detailed, and there's not really much to clarify or to add. And if that's in reference to comments made by Mr. Bannon, I'd refer you back to the ones that he made previously on 60 Minutes, where he called the collusion with Russia about this president a total farce.
That report from RT's Caleb Maupin. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson played host to the foreign and defense ministers of Qatar. Tillerson was joined by Defense Secretary General James Mattis and their Qatari counterparts from the Al-Thani family at a press conference in Washington Tuesday.
Well, good morning, all. And the United States is very pleased to host this inaugural U.S.-Qatar strategic dialogue. I want to welcome Foreign Minister Al-Thani, Minister of Defense Al-Attiyah, and the entire Qatari delegation to Washington. And I want to express my thanks and appreciation to Secretary Mattis for joining us for this dialogue as well. Qatar is a strong partner and a longtime friend of the United States. We value the U.S.-Qatar relationship and hope the talks today deepen our strategic ties. In today's strategic dialogue sessions, we will discuss important areas of cooperation, including trade and investment, security, counterterrorism, energy, and aviation. The United States believes enhanced trade will contribute positively to both our countries' economic development and create jobs for the American people and Qatari citizens while furthering the region's security and stability. The United States welcomes the understandings we reached on civil aviation yesterday. These exchanges address concerns important to U.S. aviation industry stakeholders and strengthen our economic cooperation. The President has made this matter a priority, and the outcome we achieved will ensure a level playing field in the global aviation market. I'm also pleased to announce that the U.S. and Qatari governments will sign a memorandum of understanding that creates a framework for the United States to provide technical assistance and training to the Qatari government on combating human trafficking. This MOU also provides for the creation of a bilateral government working group to discuss labor practices in Qatar. Through our continued cooperation, we hope to partner with Qatar to build institutional capacity to eliminate human trafficking, an area in which Qatar has already made significant strides. With respect to counterterrorism, following President Trump's challenge to all of our Gulf partners during the Riyadh summit last year, Qatar has made significant progress to improve efforts to combat terrorism. As a result of the Memorandum of Understanding our countries signed in July, the United States and Qatar have increased information sharing on terrorists and terrorist financiers. We have participated in counterterrorism technical training and taken steps to improve aviation security. We look forward to building on this foundation and implementing next steps. We will also discuss other critical regional security issues, including the ongoing battle to defeat ISIS, Daesh, the Gulf dispute, the situation in Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan, and Iran's role in the region. As the Gulf dispute nears the 8-month mark, the United States remains as concerned today as we were at its outset. This dispute has had direct negative consequences economically and militarily for those involved, as well as the United States. We are concerned by the rhetoric and propaganda employed in the region, playing out daily in Arab mainstream and social media. It is critical that all parties minimize rhetoric, exercise restraint to avoid further escalation, and work toward a resolution. A united GCC bolsters our effectiveness on many fronts, particularly on countering terrorism, defeating ISIS, and countering the spread of Iran's malign influence. The United States and Qatar will be signing three documents today outlining our cooperation in the important bilateral and regional areas mentioned, including three at this ceremony. The first is a memorandum of understanding that establishes the convention for this U.S.-Qatar strategic dialogue on an annual basis going forward, so that we can continue to build on the close partnership between our two countries. The second document is a joint declaration outlining the United States' cooperation with Qatar on matters of shared regional and security interest. The third document is a memorandum of understanding that creates a framework for the cooperation between the United States and Qatar to combat human trafficking. I look forward to the outcomes of today's inaugural U.S.-Qatar strategic dialogue and our continued collaboration over the years to come. And with that, I'd welcome remarks from Foreign Minister Al-Thani.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Good morning, dear friend Secretary Tillerson, dear friend Secretary Mattis, Your Excellencies, member of the two delegations of the U.S.-Qatar Strategic Dialogue, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to express on behalf of the Qatari delegation our deepest gratitude for the warm welcome. This year, we are celebrating the 45th anniversary of the U.S.-Qatar Alliance. Our work today represents a milestone in a historically deep and continuous relationship between Qatar and the United States in defense, economic, education, and political unions. Holding this immensely significant first session of Qatar-U.S. strategic dialogue come as an expression and a celebration of the enduring and close affiliation between our two countries. In a recent January phone call between the President of the United States, Donald Trump, and His Highness the Emir of Qatar, they have emphasized their mutual determination to strengthen the bilateral relation. A number of major agreements will be signed today, covering defense, trade, investment, and energy, all areas where Qatar is committed to investing in America's economy. Qatar is already investing more than $100 billion in the U.S. economy, including $10 billion earmarked for infrastructure. Qatar and U.S. private sector have devoted substantial resources to the other. U.S. companies doing business in Qatar within construction, energy, and services industry. Qatari companies are investing in the U.S. financial services, healthcare, and technology markets. From Qatar hosting six prominent U.S. universities in our education city, to Qatar investment in the LNG Golden Pass in Texas, our countries have shared interests. Interests that translate into job opportunities for the American and Qatari people. To make all these investments flourish, regional security is essential. So today, we will also discuss a range of security issues, including shared threats and further opportunities of regional cooperation. This joint endeavor takes place despite the difficult circumstances that Qatar currently faces. As a part of a larger regional crisis taking place in the Middle East, the state of Qatar and its people have been illegally and unjustifiably blockaded. This blockade disrupts the joint efforts in providing stability for the region. Let me express my profound gratitude for the effort of the President Trump, the U.S. Congress, and Secretaries Tillerson and Mattis and Mnuchin in taking a just position on the illegal activities of the blockading states throughout this Gulf crisis. We look forward to our continued cooperation on regional security to deliver long-lasting peace and security for the Middle East. In addition to security, both countries are committing to improving labor standards and joining forces to stop all forms of human trafficking. Qatar and U.S. are committed to delivering justice to our citizens. In closing, I reiterate my appreciation for your effort to ensure that this first round of the strategic dialogue will be held successfully. We look forward to hosting the second round in Doha next year. Our mutual goal is to deepen strategic bonds between our two countries and go forward together to yield the greatest mutual benefit. Thank you.
Excuse me. Secretary Tillerson, thank you for hosting this inaugural Qatar-United States Security Dialogue with our counterparts, Foreign Minister Al-Thani, and my friend, the Minister of State for Defense, Al-Attiyah. The United States enjoys a long-standing defense relationship with Qatar, a strong and valued military partner. Qatar is a longtime friend in the region. Even in the midst of its own current challenges, Qatar and the United States maintain excellent military-to-military relations. Hosting Al Udeid Air Base, home to our combined Air Operations Center, United States Air Force Central Command Forward Headquarters, and U.S. Central Command's Forward Headquarters, providing critical counterterrorism support to the Defeat ISIS, Defeat Daesh Coalition, and President Trump's South Asia strategy. We are grateful to Qatar for their longstanding support of America's presence and continuing commitment to regional security, a commitment that includes information sharing and counterterrorism training. It should be noted that just this last week, the Qatari Air Force completed its first two C-17 flights from the Gulf to Afghanistan and back, providing logistical support to the NATO counterterrorism campaign in Afghanistan. As Secretary Tillerson stated, a United Gulf Cooperation Council bolsters our effectiveness on many fronts, particularly on countering terrorism, defeating ISIS-Daesh, and countering the spread of Iran's malign influence. It is thus critical that the GCC recovers its cohesion as the proud Gulf nations return to mutual support through a peaceful resolution that provides for enhanced regional stability and prosperity. I look forward to a lasting Qatar-U.S. security relationship, a relationship that will continue to bolster our efforts against common security threats and violent extremism. So thank you, and Minister Al-Attiyah.
Secretary Tillerson, General Mattis, thank you. Distinguished colleague, I reaffirm the remark raised by Sheikh Mohammed regarding our special relation with the U.S. Qatar and the United States have long enjoyed special relationship, a relationship built on a mutual respect and trust. We have stood together many times in the face of tyranny, fought those who defy the rule of law, and worked jointly to confront the complex and expensive challenges that face our region today. The relationship extends beyond the security, defense, and political. It extends in the educational, as Sheikh Mohammed said, energy sector, commerce, and social tie. I speak of the special relation that we share with our friend and allies here in the United States, and there is no better way to demonstrate the uniqueness of this relation than by looking at our military-to-military partnership. As some of you are acutely aware, Qatar and the United States have been strategic military allies for quite some time now. We have shared our friend burden and have carried on our own weight in the effort to bring peace, justice, and stability to our region and beyond. This inaugural meeting marks an important moment in our relationship with our friend here. In the U.S., we look forward to building on the existing infrastructure of our historic and strategic relationship through exploring a way in which we are able to expand our bilateral coordination and further our effort to in realizing our shared objective of peace, security, and prosperity for our nation and beyond. The state of Qatar has never wavered its commitment to stand with the friends and allies, especially when they needed us the most. When others in the region were no longer able to accommodate U.S. presence of their soil, Qatar eased restriction and expedited its offer to host its ally, Al Udeid Air Base, which currently hosts 11,000 of your brave men and women, has been at the epicenter of the global fight against terrorism. Qatar has spared no effort in increasing the readiness and efficiency of Al Udeid operation by investing billions of dollars in the direct infrastructure and maintenance of the strategic airbase. We are looking toward the future of our military partnership with the United States as we plan for the year ahead. Qatar and its trusted ally have reaffirmed their commitment toward the stability and prosperity of both nations. The recent purchase of the F-15s fighter jet signals a new era of cooperation. This strategic bird will assure our readiness to protect our own border and aid our allies further in our collective fight toward peace and stability. Creation of tens of thousands of jobs, direct new jobs, and tens of thousands more of indirect creation jobs. The initiative has been jointly constructed ensure, and I'm referring to the military initiative which we are looking to achieve in Qatar, and we call the 2041, has been jointly constructed to ensure the safety of the forces serving in Al Udeid and facilitate future capacity building by alleviating the classification of Al Udeid to permanent U.S. base. The cooperative initiative will include the exchange of military personnel and the expansion of Al Udeid Air Base and include on-base housing for the American service member and their families, new state-of-the-art schools, as well as building quality recreational entertainment and service facility. Qatar has demonstrated its commitment to well-being of the community of American service member in Al Udeid and their family, who serves alongside them by facilitating for needs. The initiative aimed to serve the needs of the community living in Al Udeid and ease their transition and assimilation. In the current Gulf conflict, the disruption of CT offered destabilizing allied forces effort in the region. Brave men and women of Qatar, since our inception, there has been those who wished to impose their domain over us. Qatar did not waver then, and it will not waver now. And to protect the sovereignty and fight of its independence, the brave people of Qatar stood firmly with their leader in face of the mounting hostility directed toward their country. They refused to be manipulated or used as a pawn in an arbitrary and pointless conflict. We are here today to work for this man and woman and for the men and women of your great country, to explore economic, social, military, and social opportunity that will progress our effort toward prosperity and stability. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
The Syrian National Dialogue Congress closed in Sochi, Russia on Tuesday. This was the Russian representative, Alexander Lavrentiev.
Thank you. Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, Russia has done a lot to maintain Syrian statehood, territorial integrity. Over the last 2 years, since the beginning of the military operation in Syria, we have destroyed the hotbed of international terrorism in Syria. In this regard, Syria, jointly with other member states of the Astana process, realize that there's a need to step up political process, the political settlement process, and we made this initiative to host the Congress of Syrian National Dialogue. As you might recall, this initiative was supported at the meeting in December of the leaders of three countries, Russia, Iran, and Turkey. We did our best to put together a list of participants so that we can bring representatives of all walks of life, Syria under one roof, representatives of internal, external opposition, representatives of the government. This goal has been reached, as we can see, because 1,393 delegates attended this event, more than 50 observers, 34 international observers, 19 UN observers, and also we have observers from US, UK, who unfortunately were represented at a fairly low level. A lot of people were eager to participate as observers, but we had to decline their requests given their roles and the significance that they played in the Syrian settlement process. So, the point I would like to make is that in the course of the entire Congress, we had a very business-like, constructive atmosphere. We're thankful to the delegates because they were really, truly driven by their sense of responsibility, patriotism, and all in all, they managed to overcome their grievances, to put them aside. Today, and we did not really register any sharp polemics, debates between the opposition and the government representatives, and that's very important. People looked face to face, and that's why this Congress was called the Syrian National Dialogue Congress. So on the outcomes of the Congress, I'd like to say that three documents have been approved. The final statement, concluding statement, an address of the participants, and a list of nominees for the Constitutional Commission. Constitutional Commission, what we call it. This list will be submitted once it goes through another endorsement. It will be submitted to Stefan de Mistura, Special UN Envoy for Syria, for further work.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.